Welcome to the new season of Philosophy vs. Improv. We are now a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information or to check out the other shows in the network, please visit evergreenpodcasts.com. This is Philosophy vs. Improv, where two sages try to teach each other a thing or two, and maybe you, the audience, get something out of it as well. My name is Mark Lintzmeyer, greeting you philosophically. To start off our big old season four.
Yes. And this is Bill Arnett greeting you improvisationally. How's it going? I just made that up. Also, can you believe it? Four seasons, Mark?
Well, so three seasons.
Three seasons. Is this the end of season three or the beginning of season four?
This is the beginning of season of the fourth year that we have been doing this. So we're seniors now. We finished our junior year. We had our summer abroad. Whatever someone might do in their junior year. And now we're senioritis.
Does this mean we can just sign ourselves out, you know?
When, does senioritis set in more like, you know, next March? Or is it like right now? I haven't had a senior. Actually, my daughter is a senior in college. I haven't noticed much difference. But a senior in high school, I feel like that's the senioritis time.
Yes. I got to see a little eighth grade senioritis doing some substitute teaching. And that's pretty rough. That was just, even the teachers were like, we have eighth grade senioritis. We're done. We are done teaching.
What, are you not let me gonna go to high school? You're going to hold me back?
Well, they don't do holdbacks anymore. That's a whole other philosophical question. How do we prevent from stigmatizing children, giving children negative stigmata, stigmatizations?
Don't give your children stigmata. I mean, that's a good Halloween. It's a very cheap Halloween costume because you just sort of draw red circles and like, yes. What are you?
If it appears naturally, if stigmata do appear, you know, go to the local parish priest and doctor, you know, probably get it checked out by both professions. But I would not force stigmata upon my children.
What do you think is the weirdest place where people have gotten stigmata? Because, you know, if you, you know, you get on your hands, you get on your feet, you recognize that it's stigmata. You recognize that it's Jesus talking through you or something like that, something Jesus adjacent.
Yes, yes.
But if you get a little hole like that in your ear, what do you do then? Is that stigmata?
Probably not stigmata. And I wonder if there's a flank stigmata from when the Roman soldier stabbed him in the flank. Die faster, Jesus. So I wonder if people get that stigmata as well.
People don't really know that for the cross thing, generally, if you're attaching something to a wall, you wouldn't want to just do the top and the bottom. You'd want one piece of tape, one staple, one nail in the middle too, right? You don't want it wiggling around, especially if it's a live creature.
If you can't find a stud, you're going to want to use a drywall anchor. You know, I don't know if anybody who has woken up with a drywall anchor in their back. That would be interesting. That would be, I'm convinced. That's the proof I need.
When the monsters who live under the bed are redecorating and they're trying to pound up their various posters, photos, I mean, it's hanging. They got to do it all four corners. So the odds of them hitting through to one of your body parts, it's not that slim.
Correct. They want to have a cool pad to hang out in, the monsters under your bed. They don't want to just all your dusty, you know, whatever people keep under their bed, plus dust, you know, I don't know.
I feel like this is an underserved narrative area of, yes, there are monsters on it, but what kind of lives do they have? Is there not light? Is there not music that, you know, you turn off your light and there's, and they're just like, they're doing their disco thing. There's, you hear sex sounds under the bed.
Oh, gross.
I mean, yeah, that would be terrifying.
I don't know if you've ever, Richard Matheson wrote the book for I Am Legend, which has been remade like four times by Hollywood movies, including Will Smith's I Am Legend. And there was also an I Am Legend for Omega Man, I want to say, Charlton Heston back in the 70s, who made it an I Am Legend.
Oh, that's the same?
Yes, I think it was all from the same source material, but they all missed the point. The big thing in the book was that if everyone in the world is a vampire, then the one guy who's not a vampire who goes around during the day killing them is the vampire. How's that, philosophy guy?
It's like you're always already doing philosophy.
Wow, it took us 3 years.
Well, to it. So that's not just a quip. That was actually the lesson that I came in here with, thinking that I would get you, I would rope you into some very mundane conversation.
It's a long con.
Like, do you think that Trump is bad?
Yes.
Ah, you're doing some ethics right there. So the idea, and this is a hypothesis.
Sure. Okay.
You alleged, you know, I'm just reminding the audience that in our very first episode, the lesson for the improv was everybody. I mean, I don't know about like paramecia. I mean, are they improvising? I guess that's a separate thing.
Ooh. Well, that just gets to the whole thing is our natural, what's the word I'm looking for? Is instinctual action improvisation?
I think if you could switch it up in light of something trying to foil your... So yeah, most animals, if they are going for the food and they run into, you know, somebody puts a piece of cardboard in front of the food, they don't just run into the cardboard and then just keep doing that.
Repeatedly.
They go around the cardboard. They knock the cardboard down. They do something so that they're improvising. So even the smallest creatures, let's say, have always already been improvising. But have we always already been, at least humans? I'm not gonna bring the paramecia into this.
No.
But the humans, have we always already been philosophizing? And so that's a reason people say you should do philosophy, because you're already philosophizing. You're just doing it poorly.
Oh, yes.
The philosophy teacher might say, no, actually, most people don't philosophize. And that's the problem, that doing philosophy is a questioning, is not just a making assumptions about stuff, you know, having a philosophy, having some underlying assumptions. It's the explicit process of stopping and looking at those. So it depends which definition of philosophy it is, whether you have already...
All right, so we're either full philosophizing or only half philosophizing.
I like that.
Okay.
I think half philosophizing could be the name of this podcast.
I don't like Donald Trump. He's stupid. Well, you're only half philosophizing. You're not asking the questions. Okay. I can get that.
The questions, do you like?
Well,
there's the question.
So here's a fun connection between that paramecium and is instinctual action improvisation. And I think if you wanted to define improv as living entirely in the moment as to what's happening right now, then I would say that that paramecium hitting a barrier and then moving around it is very much aware of its now. And like, I can't get through, I smell something, I want to get around this, I'm going to start moving around it. I think that would count. So if the opposite is then not being in the moment, or constantly measuring the moment or trying to consider the moment, then that would be not improv, I guess. I was just doing some reading for something I was working on, but it was how the founders of this country, the framers of the Constitution, when trying to figure out how to...
The frounders,
trying to figure out how to make a republic. You know, there had been some small republics, you know, city-state republics in history and throughout the Alps and whatnot, but as I learned, but there hadn't been a big one since Rome. That was the last like huge republic that, you know, lasted any appreciable length of time. And one of the things they came across is that whole notion, I don't know which philosophers talked about it, how many people are so inside themselves, they aren't aware of what the effects of their actions might have on others. If that makes sense. And I think it's like you have to be able to transcend your own wants and needs to be able to think about politics. And I think that's true about philosophy. And you can't be so inside yourself, you are unaware that I want a job. I want those immigrants out of here. I want home. It's like you can't be so inside yourself to not be aware of your unaware of your surroundings. And that the rabble, what the real problem with the rabble and the marketplace is they can't not only think about their own wants and needs.
I mean, clearly one could be a solipsist. That is a philosophical position. So you're literally not aware, not acknowledging that other people have wants and needs or that other people even exist. So
do people think that's healthy? Is that
no, that's a bad kind of philosophy. I think you're sort of saying to be properly philosophical, you have to be to approach politics, to approach your own needs in a philosophical way, is to be reflective. And what does that mean? Well, it means seeing things in a context.
Well, I think the similarity of the improv is I can't be so inside my own head trying to push my own agenda and trying to only think about my own things that I'm not aware of what's going on around me. and the people around me that I'm improvising with. So I think there's a fun connection there between improvising well and political thought. It took us 3 years to get here.
Can you have a deeply us versus them attitude in either of those fields? Let's put it that way. Like you have to, right? You have to acknowledge some people, but you probably don't have to acknowledge everybody.
Sure.
Right? You could be just our tribe.
The people who can vote.
Our elites. Yes. Our small, we're a republic. 5% of us can vote. We have a great egalitarian, you know, one person, one vote democracy in that small group. And then I guess we represent everybody else.
You know, it's a sliding scale, I guess, is what we're saying. And even though I might be trying to not be within myself in an improv scene, I still hope I'm aware of able to get inside myself a little bit. Oh, it'd be funny if I did this, or playing the game a little bit inside my own head a little bit. I'm not lost in the moment. I'm not completely unaware of my own place in the moment. I'm not unaware of that line tanked. What am I, dude? You got to come on, tighten up. You're not doing very well. You know, it's like I am inside myself a little bit, but still aware of what's going on, hopefully, in the moment, you know?
Well, so how about just this in-group, out-group thing, the relative awareness of your scene partners, mm-hmm. small community versus the potential viewers, the audience. Mm-hmm. You just improv like there's nobody else except your scene partners in the world.
As a musician, I'm sure you've probably come across that question before. Is the audience just there to see you do art, you know, or do they come to be entertained? Do they have something as well? You know, that's a big question, I guess. And I guess that's the difference between mass market entertainment and more niche entertainment. If I choose to watch a David Lynch movie, I kind of want David Lynch. I don't want David Lynch trying to make concessions to the audience, you know.
I want David Lynch in a corner of the screen going, "You got that?"
I understand. He can be a little polarizing, and I'm not saying I'm an absolute fanboy of David Lynch, but I do appreciate his work. I will want to be on record as saying that. Maybe not Dune, but everything else. The whole thing where I think there are interesting artists, interesting people, where I just kind of want to stand back and let them do their thing. Don't worry about me. But then there's other times where please do worry about me. Talk up so I can hear you. Don't turn your back to me. I want to be able to see what's going on, you know, the kind of stage things. But then again, too much of that, it could be pandering.
A bon vivant once criticized my children's onstage play that was entirely in Spanish, classroom play, as they kept the fun carefully controlled only within that group of children who were facing each other because they were talking so low. And that was me. That was my criticism. In other words, I couldn't understand a damn thing they were saying. It's not just because they were speaking Spanish. It was because...
Okay. Yeah.
They weren't given projection lessons. I expect my teachers, as a substitute teacher, how are you doing on teaching your kids to project?
My own kids, I'm doing fine. One thing that helps is having a moderate hearing disability. So first thing in the morning, they have to project or daddy's not getting them breakfast. So that's...
Is that because you're just blasting your metal in your headphones? As
a boy, too much hardcore heavy metal, too much jackhammer operating.
Well, I just meant because my kids were recently, this is what it's like talking to you because I would wear my headphones, my noise cancellation headphones around the house and they're trying to ask me questions and they could be dead in the other room. I don't know.
That's a little aggressive. That's a little aggressive. I will say modern hearing aids now, which I do wear, moderate disability, but the last insurance I had covered hearing aids. So we got the Cadillac plan of hearing aids.
I didn't notice when we were in person. Were you wearing them at the show?
Yes, I was.
Oh, well, they're very discreet.
Very discreet. And I don't really care. It came on later in life between me and my sisters. We all turned 30 and quit hearing the television. My folks had okay hearing. Grandparents had okay hearing. So it was just a losing the genetic lottery between me and my sister. It's like, well, thanks, mom and dad.
Well, you're already philosophizing about that. It's not just that you had this. It's that it's okay. You're putting it in the perspective of your siblings. You know that other people have it worse in the world. You know that this is this is treatable. You're not merely moaning and groaning like the paramecium who hits that cardboard wall and then cries
into a depression hole.
Those goddamn paramecia.
This is my life. Why am I so simple? Why am I such a simple creature?
Can I not get a second cell?
Please?
I could do so many things. I could do twice as many things if I had two cells.
Stuck with a flagella. Why can't I get some cilia rather than this dumb flagella?
Yeah, geez. Ugh. And then they see an amoeba. Like, oh, they think they're so cool, those amoebas. They can like split in half and stuff. And
cruising around like they're in a motorboat right through the ectoplasm.
They could be in a nucleus. And I can't. I'm really running out of things. I really don't remember a lot of details about what single-celled animals can and can't do and how they relate to each other.
Well, they can't have that thought process. I think that's true.
I mean, a bunch of them, if they line up and they kind of bump into each other, then maybe that could make a thought. See, I'm doing philosophy already. Whenever you're joking about something, you're doing philosophy because you're saying this is funny and that itself is a theory. And then when somebody thinks your joke is not funny, they're like, I dispute your theory.
You're at the office and you feel someone over your shoulder. You turn around and you see them and you recognize them. Are we not at a philosophical crossroads where it's like, I don't want to talk to this person, but it would be rude to not talk to them? Is that a choosing to be polite when your instinct is to be like, shut up, go away? We're not having lunch today. I just said yes to be nice and I really had no intention. Is that philosophy?
Yeah, because it fits in with how fundamental is the questioning? Because you're saying there is questioning. Should I talk to this person or should I do what I want to do? How deep does that go? Are you trying to figure out what the social norm is? Are you trying to figure out if there's just some way that, you know what the social norm is. You're trying to figure out if you can get out of doing this thing in a way that will still go along with the social norm. So it's a matter of cleverness. It's not necessarily a matter of philosophy. If you say, oh, and then you get on your phone.
Yeah.
And then you turn around and then you walk away with the phone and you talk to nobody for a sec. Like you've solved that problem. Perhaps. Maybe they won't buy it.
With a clearly audible dial tone the whole time. I'm waiting for the dial tone to end. I heard if you just listen to a dial tone for a long time.
Let me get that phone. They don't believe me. They grab the phone out of your hands and it says, the time is now 7:09. Beep.
Yes. A joke for everybody born in the 70s.
Can you still call time from your cell phone that tells you the time? Can you do that?
What you do, it just says, are you joking? Really? Are you kidding? Is this a joke?
I'm looking it up. Can I call time? Can I still call time? Yes. As of January 2024, calling 202-762-1401 from anywhere in the U.S. will give a correct time from EST or UTC time. So we can't, as central time zoners, we'd have to do some math. And by the time you do the math, well, the time's already changed.
What is time?
Just by saying those three words, you're being philosophical.
Yeah.
You don't need any answer.
I think we've talked about the whole, and you even mentioned earlier, the kind of like half philosophy or armchair philosophy or stoner college student back porch philosophy.
Yeah.
What would we call that? Is there a formal name for half philosophy, for that kind of just whimsically pondering about the world?
I mean, it's just a style. It's a style of philosophy. You'd have to say. Okay. There are many different styles of philosophy. And until you get a particular, right, analytic philosophy is a division within philosophy because supposedly the people who practice it have some sort of rigorous, have you analyzed all the concepts that you're using? Do they fit together in some, you know, it just means be rigorous in some nebulous way. Maybe use some formal logic if you can. Use things that look like math in your arguments and then whoa, look how rigorous you are.
Okay, all right. I just don't imagine that level of rigor on top of the science building, looking at the stars getting stoned.
Right. So they would not be doing analytic philosophy. I recall hearing one of the analytic philosophers we have talked about on the Partially Examined Life recently. Mm-hmm. It's this Tim Williamson, who we're actually going to talk to in our next discussion, a guy that we've talked about. Now we're going to talk to him. And he said, ask why I'm an analytic philosopher. Because I wanted to check out what these continental philosophers were talking about. So I went to their colloquia. I went to their groups. And it seemed like it was a lot of deferring to people, he says, on the basis of their prominence in the field without actually understanding what they were talking about.
Okay.
That he just thought it was a bunch of bullshit. Ideas that had not been carefully thought out. But that people were like, oh, the great Foucault, you cannot disagree with the great Foucault. You must Oh, well, you're just stupid if you don't understand Heidegger, if you don't understand these basic things that we are. Now, that's probably a very uncharitable approach to a whole other branch of philosophy, but at least he tried. At least he went over there and hung out there. I feel like unless you do that, you don't really even know what their standards are.
Well, that whole kind of like dogma, you know, are we just, they're stuck in the philosophical. There has to be one truth, one right answer, one method of doing things, and it becomes dogmatic.
Well, the dogmatic could even just be the limits, right? If we're in any kind of scientific or political or any other sphere, and somebody starts talking about astrology or something, you're going to be like, no. And they'll be, you're being so dogmatic, dismissing my crystals, dismissing my...
I could see how that complaint could be leveled. I may not agree with that complaint. What happens? It happens a lot in improv, where there are some... Viola Spolin is the name. She is considered the founding mother of improv. She ran a home for, I don't know, wayward. It wasn't really an orphanage. But in Chicago in the late 19th century, you had lots of immigrants coming in. And it was a school and kind of thing. She ran Hull House, it was called. And she was the first social worker ever. But she devised all these little games that kids could play that didn't speak the same language. A lot of them involved physical things or pantomiming. And those all kind of became the first, quote unquote, improv games or improv exercises. And there are many people who will still just be like, oh, hey, great show. That was really nice. You know, I could see Spolin in there, left, right, and center. That's why it was so good, because you went to the source. And it's like, oh, what are you talking about? I've never read her book. I don't, you know, anything that was Spolin has been, sure, it's in everything now, but you know what I'm saying? It was so long ago. It has been so leveraged by everybody else that the original stuff has little meaning.
This is making me certainly think of a lot of stuff. I'm right now, for Pretty Much Pop, watching some of the classic Universal Monster movies.
Great.
Which are in themselves pretty boring. And, you know, we knew that they would be slow paced and but I've been a little surprised by them, because it is the kind of thing that is passed down, that what you're reacting to as a modern horror fan, or maybe even some of the movie makers, I don't know. I would imagine a lot of them have watched these. They're only from the 1930s. They're not 200 years old. They're, you know,
but they're almost 100 years old.
But then, yes, gosh, to think even if we pay tribute, oh, those classic Universal Monster movies, the Wolfman, you know, Dracula, you know, Frankenstein, like, is the thing that you're even talking about have anything to do? Like, are you really, I don't know what the authority is, because the authority is just like, these things are cool.
Yeah.
I could see a peer pressure, not exactly authority, but like, okay, there's an aesthetic that, having now gone to with you after our show, my first real full-length multi-performer, multi-group improv show, is an aesthetic that you have to, I was well prepared by our many scenes to appreciate what the various people were doing on stage, even though somebody who was not familiar with it would say, this is boring.
careful.
Only occasionally funny. Like, if their standard is people that have worked on a script.
Yes.
And is delivered by Adam Sandler and all your other favorite wacky people, then they're not going to be prepared for this. The way, you know, that I'm vicariously improvising with you, even if I'm not on stage, I know what it's like to do this. And so I'm see the puzzle from your point of view, the improver, and anything you do, like, it's really interesting to see how you respond to the puzzle. And it would be the same thing, you know, with lots of philosophy subcommunities, or even just the explanation of basic philosophy, that if you get a 12-year-old in there, some of them might be just like, wow, this is a really interesting new thing. But a lot of them would be, this is not satisfying. This is not like the latest Marvel movie. Boring. Two people talking on a podcast, just talking. What's that about?
I was a guest teacher at an improv camp. It was like a long weekend camp, Improv Utopia. And they had me come out to be an instructor. It was a wonderful time, a fun time. Actually, we talked about trying to get the manager there on as a guest out here sometime.
Uh-huh.
And, well, one of my students was an older woman, easily well past 65, I'd say. And she was a psychologist. And she always had very interesting, she could not be thinking about the psychology of everything at all times, which was a little annoying. That's what it is. But in chatting with her, she said, you know, I kind of got involved in improv just kind of tangentially with some of these smaller groups. but she lived either in New York City or near New York City and said, you know, so I decided I was going to go down to one of the big improv theaters in New York City, the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, the UCB Theater in New York. And this would have been 5, 6, 7 years ago. And she's like, you know what? I had a hard time enjoying the show because it felt like I went to someone else's church. Everybody knew when to stand, when to sit, when to laugh, when to have what reaction, like you went to someone else's church. Mm-hmm. But I don't, oh, it's a hymn. Oh, no. Okay. We don't kneel. Do we kneel? Is this a kneeling church or not? Okay. And she just felt like out of place. In that same way you mentioned, you know, when you appreciate the aesthetic of something.
Is that related to the dogmatism point, to the deferring to authority? In other words, you might stand up in the middle of an improv, like, you people are all, while watching an improv performance, let's say this, you know, when you're 2 hours into an improv, you say, you people are all, you know, have drunk the Kool-Aid. What the hell is wrong with you? This is objectively not entertaining. you're merely deferring to authority, and people might feel ambivalent about that. I mean, that's how I feel about most things. Like, look, I realize from a certain point of view, as I'm watching some horror anime or something like that, from a certain point of view, this is very objectionable in various ways.
Yeah.
But I can catch its vibe well enough that I'm going to keep doing this right now. But I don't know how I feel about it. This is, you know, guilty pleasures or all the various ambivalent feelings we might have toward the things we consume.
You can get outside yourself a little bit in a good way.
Or in a negative way, right? Being self-conscious has two meanings, as we've talked about, that being this greater awareness that you're talking about, that's being philosophical, being a better improviser because you're aware more of what's going on. Or are you self-conscious as in self-critical, as in ambivalent, doubting, should I even be doing this? I know I've had that episode that got delayed from May to recently. That was just because we did it and I didn't know how I felt about it when we did it. And when I finally listened back to it and Tyler listened, you know, edited it and said, you know, this is fine. Then I was like, I should have been fine with this. This is no worse than many other things we've done. Let's put it that way.
Well, isn't that what, I probably butcher it now, and I don't know how much cred Freud has anymore, but since something talking about people with psychoses, just minor, I can make it through the day.
So neurosis versus psychosis. Is that what you're talking about? Neurosis.
It's people who can't get their own thoughts out of the way. They can't get out of their own way. That they're constantly or destructively unable to think of anything other than their own place and what's going on. I thought that was interesting and kind of like, we all do it from time to time, but we should be able to turn it off, or it shouldn't get to a point where it becomes destructive or keeps us from being in the moment, being alive at any given moment. That inability to really be alive, I think, is what would be missing from someone who struggles with neuroses.
Or is that just that your way of the patterns that we have strategies? We don't entirely improvise, right? Because we're creatures of habit. That if we had to entirely improvise all the time, we would not know what to do next, or we would be very random mercurial creatures. We would not.
Annoying.
Yes, yes.
Third graders.
So having a healthy underlying habitual layer to your personality, right? And these could be good habits. It's things that you've cultivated so that, for instance, when somebody says a critical thing to me, I will not immediately kick them in the face. I will have some sort of the habit of stopping to think. So I guess improvising itself could be the connection between improvising, which is anti-habitual, and habit, which could provide a foundation, could say, this is the place where it's okay to improvise. This is okay.
There's something in there for sure. And that whole, where does character stop and actor begin? What percentage of yourself is in the moment, lost in the moment, like a, you know, a method actor? But then what percentage of you is aware? I think dialing in that right percentage can be an important skill and ability. And certainly from show to show and from team to team, you may have a different dial setting, if that makes sense. And there may be some super artistic movement, art, kind of, you know, very avant-garde stuff where you're completely lost in what's going on. But then other shows where it's like, no, I'm pretty aware of what's happening and I'm very much, oh, we only got 20 minutes. Okay. Yeah. Okay. You know, it's like,
I had heard all this stuff about being a method actor and I was confused and I thought it was about being a meth head actor. Oh. So I took a lot of meth to like really get in the role of townsperson number three.
You found out the hard way what the truth is.
And yeah, I didn't do a good job.
No.
I mean, they said I literally stole the show. I stole everything, all the props, the scenery, and I stole them for more meth.
Yes. Well, there was some story about Laurence Olivier dogging on, oh, I don't know, I forgot who it was, not Dustin Hoffman, some big actor whose name I can't recall. Anyway, this guy.
I'm just going to say Jack Klugman. Go ahead.
It was probably not Klug.
Not the Klugger.
I don't think it was Klug. Who's the other?
Sorry, young people.
Hoo-ah!
Oh, it was Tony Randall. It was Al Pacino, you're saying.
Al Pacino. I think it was Al Pacino. I'm not sure if someone's people frantically going to IMDb. Did Al Pacino and Laurence Olivier ever perform in the same thing? But Al Pacino, famous, you know, ham. Well, it's that whole, yeah, again, method actor. And they was having some conversation about it. Pacino was complaining about something, how he couldn't figure something out or couldn't find his character. And Laurence Olivier, it was like, have you considered acting? Like, maybe pretend. Has that crossed your mind? Pretend? which is a pretty good dig. But to pretend, one must be aware of both your own self and the thing you're pretending to be. And I think there's something interesting. There's some duality in there.
I heard something with Anthony Hopkins. He often does these looking off into the middle distance sort of content. And the person was asking him, so, you know, what are you thinking of at this time? What are you, yeah. What are you putting yourself in the character? Are you, he's like, no, I'm literally just staring off into space. Like, I let the audience decide what they think that I'm thinking, but I really am just empty of mind. I'm in the moment.
It's such a great counterbalance to the, you know, when Daniel Day-Lewis was Lincoln, he like wore his Lincoln costume and had his Lincoln beard everywhere he went. There's pictures of him getting coffee on days when he's not even shooting. He's still in his Lincoln costume getting coffee.
Chomping on them logs, those Lincoln logs.
As if Lincoln was drinking lattes, you know, unless you're having like...
That's a pretty good show, the Lincoln Latte. Have you seen that?
So if you were really Lincoln, dude, you wouldn't be at this French cafe having a pastry. You'd be having, I don't know, apple cider and fried eggs. I don't know what...
How many Lincolns are in... We're entering Halloween season. How many Lincolns are in haunted houses? Because like it could be like, hello, I'm... And then you get the exploding head. I think this would be a pretty good haunted house room.
Yeah.
You can have that, haunted house managers listening to this.
Well, I was thinking you could have the ghost of Abraham Lincoln. Oh, welcome, kids. It's me, the ghost of Abraham Lincoln. I just wanted to answer your questions and have a wonderful time taking you on a tour of the White House. And the second he turns around, you see the back of his head is just a crater, you know, and the kids are, ah! Well, what's wrong, kids? Don't you want to learn about the White House and the Civil War? Don't turn around. It's horrible. You know, he's got like a spaghetti dinner for the back of his head. You know, it's all just gross back there.
You could have a whole historical. I mean, did you know that Betsy Ross actually was, you know, one of those industrial laundry machines, just chomped her right up and, you know, right up to her whole legs and her lower body was ground to mush. And so it'd be like, oh, look at me. I'm knitting my flag. Whoop.
Yeah.
And then you see her mangled. These are not historically accurate examples, but
Lincoln was shot. That is accurate.
I mean, so they say.
He was shot accurately as well. Yeah. There was a Stephen King short story called The Mangler.
That's exactly what I was had in mind.
Industrial laundry machine possessed by a demon. It's like, really? Let's just close the door that room is in, that the machine is in, and just, I think we're done with that.
Don't use that room. Yeah.
Don't use that one. Yeah, unplug it. Yeah. But back to the idea of this, how method actors are so in character. The other kind of hilarious Hollywood anecdote I love are the actors who don't even know their own lines. And there are people, other actors with cue cards, you know, there was some story about, I'm having a real hard time with my recalling names. What was his name? Not Orson Welles, but another guy who was in.
Orson Scott Card? Orson from.
He was a hunk and then he got big.
Schwarzenegger?
Oh, Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah, that guy.
He became kind of a punchline.
Yeah, the fat guy.
Yeah. We'll edit this out, folks. Don't worry.
Now you made me not remember the name of one of these most famous actors in the world.
Yes.
I'm just finding the characters of Street.
Apocalypse Now. He was Colonel Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. Marlon Brando.
Yes, let's not edit this out just so that people are actually screaming at us.
Marlon Brando, you fools.
Very basic. Like if you know the names of five actors from yesteryear, that would be one of them.
There are stories of him in his later movies where he has cue cards taped to the other actors' chests, taped to the set pieces, taped to the back of chairs, taped to the water pitcher on the table. So as he's walking around, waddling around, doing his scenes, he's always arriving at a place where he can see his cue cards. But is it good enough? But you wouldn't have guessed that by watching the movie. I mean, his characters are kind of odd and whatnot, and kind of, but it's not like, oh, he's reading his cue. It's not obvious to us that he's reading his cue cards. So it's just funny to me that the two extremes of someone who is so in character and someone who can't even get into character.
So this is again kind of making me think about people who feel like they're in the wrong church that are hear about Frank Zappa's appearance on Saturday Night Live. You know, he's a performer, but yet somehow he just could not take the whole thing seriously. And so he just really overtly read off the cue cards which are always there because it's the live thing. And I guess, you know, whatever the scene is, they have...
It's supposed to be a safety net. It's supposed to be a safety net.
Very obviously, like, as if I spite this whole thing, I'm going to, in my seeming improv, undermine improv.
Well, it happens from time to time. And it's that whole, that was very, very funny once. Don't do it again. You know, like, that was really funny. That's kind of like, you pulled our pants down, all right? Great. We're not having you back. Right. Just FYI.
Right. I feel like we should do a improv scene that just lasts the whole rest of our time here, however that long that may be. And
we certainly
try to sum up some of the things that have happened that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you have an idea for how to start us off?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That is not in an office.
Oh, not in an office, huh?
Hey, moms. Looking for some lighthearted guidance on this crazy journey we call parenting? Join me, Sabrina Kohlberg. And me, Andy Mitchell, for Pop Culture Moms, where each week we talk about what we're watching and examine our favorite pop culture moms up close to try to pick up some parenting hacks along the way. Come laugh, learn, and grow with us as we look for the best tips and maybe a few what not to do's from our favorite fictional moms. From Good Morning America and ABC Audio, Pop Culture Moms. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Step on into the lounge, Mark. You can come into the teacher's lounge now. You're a senior. You can step into the teacher's lounge.
Because I'm a senior, I get to be the perks of being a teacher?
Well, just you can come and meet your professors and the teacher. It's fine. Feel free to grab some coffee or light up your pipe here at Brambleberry College.
Okay.
You know, we like to think of our seniors more as peers than as students.
I mean, I see a lot of seniors around here that they seem to all be a minimum of 70 years old. You seem to be the youngest
professor
among them. Among the professors.
I am. It's fine. Are you 21 yet? Doesn't matter. Grab a brandy. Grab a brandy and meet me in a chair by the fire.
So this is part of your trying to get me to apply to grad school, that this was what might await me.
You've seen right through me. You've seen right through all of us. If you feel grad school is in your future, but if you don't feel, in fact, let's talk about your fourth year now, Mark.
Yeah.
What are we going to accomplish?
I figured maybe not be in school anymore.
Okay. Yes. Graduate.
Graduate.
Finish matriculation.
I feel like I've been doing classes for a long time. It's been 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, I'm going to count kindergarten. You know, I was actually in nursery school, so 19 years. That's a lot of school. Do you think that's maybe enough? One could just be done with this? Or, but then I wouldn't get to be in this lounge. Maybe I could be a janitor in this lounge.
Well, you still have one more year to attend. And I would hope any graduate of Brambleberry College.
You got it.
Would certainly be more the janitor, perhaps head janitor, perhaps grounds manager.
Yeah, no, I think with my degree here from Brambleberry, I mean, I've been very inspired by
Brambleberry,
our team the Brandleberry Chuck Paws.
Murray, Brandleberry.
The Brandleberry Chuck Paws and the their mascot, Mr. Chucky the Chuck Paw. You know, he's always like chucking. He's always digging. I feel like there are always new places I can go. That's why grad school seems like it's not a new place to go. It seems like it is continuing to be in the same place.
Oh, okay. So perhaps at the conclusion of this year number four, you will leave your education?
That is definitely a hope, because there's a whole wide world out there to explore, to chuck through.
Wow. Okay. I have heard of students having a gap year, of using the time to go out into the field, out of the laboratory, into the field, and see what that is like. See what that world is like and how it pertains or doesn't pertain to their formal education.
At the very least, a gap year. I am a little afraid, I will say, having been so institutionalized by these 19 consecutive years of schooling, that maybe out in this wide world, I will feel a sense of, it's like those people who've been in prison for so long and they don't know what to do with themselves. And they,
so they come back, they commit crime, they are recidivists.
So I might have to, come up with a research idea that I have to come back and have the resources of the university and the Chuck Paws.
Your grades have been acceptable. Are you aware that in the real world, there is no quiz bowl?
You can't just like memorize something the night before and then, you get your paycheck.
Well, that's just not how. There's just no quiz bowl in the room. So I know you're a captain of the quiz bowl team and have brought much glory here at Brandlebury.
I mean, you could go in a bar and there's trivia that's sort of similar to quiz bowl. There are things that are sort of like the reward systems that we get in school, outside of school. So I've heard. I've never been out there.
I hear if you do well in a quiz bowl, you may get some free mozzarella sticks. If you feel that will pay the rent, moss sticks with a side of marinara sauce.
I know pretty much what you do. Like, there's nothing you actually produce that makes enough money to pay your salary, right? So you're kind of...
On the contrary, I produce minds. I produce brains of future leaders. You are aware that the CEOs of several Fortune 500 companies have considered sending their children here?
I guess I didn't know that. I mean, that's a good scam you got going there. I'm just wondering, is there a way that outside of the university environment, I can also get people to pay me to kind of dick around and do the kind of stuff that you do? Without, being in this
sailor talk. Yes. Well, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there's many corporations and businesses. Tell me, what do your parents do? Are they CEOs or COOs or CFOs?
They're professors.
Ah.
Yeah. So pretty much even before I was in nursery school, I was in scholastic environments. I was living on campuses. It was Elderwine University is where they...
Yes, a fine liberal arts college here in New England. One of many.
Yeah, so I really got that kind of... It's good to have seen some different mascots over the years. The Elderwine Berry Boy is not as good as our Chalk Paw.
Good. No, of course not. I believe we might play them in D4 athletics. On the years when we can field a volleyball team and we have enough interested participants. So this must feel like home to you. That's what I'm trying to... This must feel like home. Why would you leave something so comfortable?
I mean, it's a home, but it's a stultifying. It's been forever. I feel like there's probably something out there, preferably in a sort of setting where, again, I can kind of just sit at a desk and not have to do very much. And then people will pay me to do that, probably through grants, because certainly nothing I'm going to produce is going to actually generate enough economic value to then support my daily needs. So I think the kind of scheme that you have set up here in academia, I think is good. I just want to do it outside of a school.
You don't think that my paper on the Gracchi brothers in the middle Republican era of Rome and comparing them to Andrew Jackson? You don't think that has an economic value?
I mean, how much did you get paid specifically to write that? Not that you were just on your sabbatical with your tenure and then you chose to write that, but did you, you know, your, how much did your publisher actually pay you?
Well, it was for an academic journal. I received several distribution copies and I received acclaim and some well-written letters from colleagues. Mark, you want to throw this? You want to leave? Is it over, Mark? Is that what you're saying? Year four will be the final year? Is that what you were saying? That's, is it over?
For the moment, as nice as this teacher's lounge is, I feel like I wanna go out there and like make my own lounge. I wanna have my own record player like you got there. I wanna have my own wet bar like you got there. I wanna have my own disco ball. Like this is a nice room.
Yes. This is a proper drawing room.
So I can be here as long as I'm even just still affiliated with the university. What about alumni? Can alumni hang out in this room?
Oh, perhaps on homecoming weekend for old time's sake, but this is reserved for faculty and select students only. If anyone were listening to this conversation, Mark, perhaps listening, they might think that you are saying that this whole thing is over, that your education is over, and this whole endeavor is coming to a close after year four. Is that what I'm hearing?
I guess it depends if I can write, come through with the thesis. It's possible that the thesis on the Moldavi brothers during the Etruscan era will require additional drafts. Maybe I won't finish by May. Maybe I'll need till August.
We'll see how it goes. Okay.
To get all the credits that I need.
Post back. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, we'll see how the credits go. I'm feeling the senioritis a little bit. So I might have to, if I don't quite finish the credits, I might need one more semester. I mean, so it's not necessarily over.
Can I tell you a secret?
Please.
I've been mailing it in for years.
So can I start mailing it in right away as an academic?
You haven't already started mailing it in? This whole endeavor?
I've been working pretty hard. I mean, that was kind of sort of the thing of this burnout with academia. It's feeling like...
Yes, I've been flying by the seat of my pants. I've been improvising for the last, I don't know, 3 years.
So when you come in and you say, well, I have this whole lesson plan, but I need to speak directly to you, and you throw your lesson plan to the side. Is there anything written on those papers?
Yes. Takeout menus from local Chinese restaurants.
Wow, this is pretty eye-opening. I guess I didn't realize that once you get in the teacher's lounge, then all the secrets of being a teacher, this is actually sounding less bad. This is sounding less like I would be told to do this, do that, do your homework, sit up straight, you know, do your lab, get your frontal lobotomy, all the stuff that I keep having to do year after year, these 19 years of schooling. It seems maybe that just being in a school, but getting to set the rules myself might be actually a different thing.
A task may never end if you never do it.
These are very inspiring words. I'm going to have to think hard on this. Maybe let's do some drinking.
That sounds like a good idea. I hope no one listening into this conversation will become disillusioned.
I'm looking around for microphones. I don't think anyone's listening to this conversation, but I mean,
good.
I perhaps if there's some sort of God, I'll have to incorporate that into my thesis. And once you allow the infinite into your thesis, I guess it could take infinitely long to complete. And maybe my parents will keep paying tuition as long as it, grad school might take.
Perhaps you could get an assistantship. The good brandies in the crystal decanter. Help yourself.
All right, that seems a good...
Okay, there it is. Okay, there it is.
You are really going method there. You got a voice.
Well, no, it was funny. I forgot what you had said, but I was just like, he wants to leave after 4 years. Is he talking about the show? Are you talking about the show?
I didn't think I was talking about the show. Jeez.
Wow.
Are you talking about the show? I'm the one... You're the one who hasn't gotten paid for quite a long time. So I...
No, I don't think I was talking about the show.
Okay, good.
You'll know when I'm talking about the show. You'll know when I'm talking about
the show. That's going to be the season finale when we have the brawl. Even if we're not feeling like it, let's just schedule that. I don't know if we've even indicated the start of the season before in our.
Yeah. Have they been mailing it in this entire time? Stay tuned and find out. Wait. I don't want to stay tuned if they're mailing.
I've been zooming it in. I mean, is that the same thing? Is that the modern version of mailing?
We do communicate over email. I don't know if that.
A little bit. We do mail, but I think a lot of jobs involve mail. What is actually the problem with phoning it in? Is that like I was supposed to go there, but instead I just phoned it in?
Well, you're supposed to Zoom call it in.
Oh, okay. So it just seems like with the advent of telecommunications, phoning it in is not such a bad thing anymore because it means. As some final words, what do people have to look forward to this year? Do you have any predictions? Do you have any?
We are trying to get some fun, interesting guests. More fun and interesting guests. We've hit all the low-hanging fruit, you know, and I think my knowledge of philosophy has grown. Mark's talent as an improviser has grown as well.
So, yes, you people listening, if you've gotten this far, if you have this much sympathy with us, probably there's somebody. Oh, my aunt lives across the street from Red Fox's grandchild who can do a spitting image of impersonation of Red Fox. Please reach out to us and connect us with Red Fox's twin grandson, clone, as it may be. So we can have some Sanford and Son action right here on this show.
Yeah.
Sanford and Son. Sanford's son.
Yeah.
Okay. Sanford's grandson. This should be a revival show. Both Sanford and Son are dead, but there are new generations of Sanford. And they still work in the junkyard.
In the e-junkyard.
Yes, with all the old JPEGs lying around.
Yes, where all your deleted files go.
And they just, were there a lot of Sanford and Son plots where they would just go through the junk and like show you cool stuff? Like, I don't remember that happening. Perhaps there was no junk involved at all.
I just like the theme song.
All right, let's put this out of its misery. Thanks for 4 years of fun, Bill. And thanks for however much listening you've done. Listeners.
Indeed. I would concur. It's been fun and it's great having knowing people are listening.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody. I